Welcome to our verse-by-verse in-depth Bible study with Bible teacher Dr. Bob Utley. Now, here's Bob.
We're starting our study in the post-exilic period. We're going to be dealing with the book of Ezra today and for the next several weeks. Let's deal quickly, because we've got several chapters to do, with authorship and date and uniqueness, okay? There are some who assert that the author of Ezra and Nehemiah is also the author of Chronicles. And though I think there's much similarity in style, I think we can attribute it to the writing style of the age. There are some idiosyncrasies to each book, and I think they're separate. Now, the rabbis and Josephus have always regarded Ezra and Nehemiah as one book. The Masoretes, who put notes at the end of every book, do not put notes at the end of Ezra, but put notes for both Ezra and Nehemiah at the end of Nehemiah, which says they believe that in the middle of the ninth century. Now, the first one to split the two books that we know of and start the tradition was Origen in A.D. 185 to 223. And he was followed by Jerome in the Vulgate. Now, Jerome thought they were one book, but he made them two when he wrote the Vulgate. In 1448, the first Hebrew Bible began to separate them, and they're separated both in the modern English and the modern Hebrew Bibles. It seems to me, though, because of the duplication of Ezra chapter 2 and Nehemiah chapter 7, that it's two separate books. E.J. Young has suggested the reason they're one book is because the Hebrews wanted to keep the same number of books in the Old Testament as there were consonants in the Hebrew alphabet, and there may be some validity to that. Now, of course, as far as the date, I think with the finding of the Elephantine papyri, which showed us Aramaic of this time, and the similarity with the royal Aramaic of Ezra, that Ezra is during the reign of Artaxerxes I. Now, let me get away from that. This book is also known, in English it's called Ezra, and you have Nehemiah. Now, there are two apocryphal books with the same name. In English, they're called First Esdras and Second Esdras. In the Septuagint, Ezra is called Esdras B, Nehemiah is called Esdras C, and the apocryphal book is called Esdras A. Now, in the Vulgate, Ezra is Esdras Roman numeral 1, Nehemiah is Esdras Roman numeral 2, First Esdras, Apocrypha, is Esdras Roman numeral 3, and Second Esdras is Esdras Roman numeral 4. And so it gets a bit confusing, but that's the different designations for this book. I've given you a brief outline and some historical information in your notes, and I hope they're helpful. Let's go to text now, if we could, please. Now, in the first year of Cyrus, king of Persia. Now, this is probably when he became king of Babylon. And so we're referring to around 538 B.C. And that's the date of the edict, let the Jews go home. For a long time, people have said, well, the king of Persia is not a title that they used. But archaeological evidence has showed it certainly was a title, and this shows the historicity of this account. Now, Cyrus is known as a very good ruler by many of the historians. Herodotus says he ruled like a father. Ctesiphon says he was a model prince. Plutarch says, in wisdom, virtue, and greatness of soul. Diodorus says that he had remarkable self-control, and even later a Roman historian Cicero had the same glowing remarks about Cyrus II. So he really was a good king. The reason he probably was so good is he let the peoples keep their traditions and cultures, and he restored them back to the places they'd been exiled from. Apparently, the policy of exile started under the Hittites, was taken over by the Assyrians and Babylonians, the Greeks used it, the Romans used it to some extent, and so Persia was the only one that resettled people and caused them to love them, and that was their way of keeping control. In order to fulfill the word of the Lord by the mouth of Jeremiah. Now, this seems to refer to the 70 years of captivity. Now, some have said, well, when you add up all these numbers, you don't get 70. I guess the only way you can really get the number 70 is to go from the destruction of the temple, 586, to the rebuilding of the second temple, 516. Now, there's 70 years exactly. Some say the number is just a round number of the lifespan of an individual. And so the exile in years was around 40, 50 years, somewhere like that. Okay? It depends on when you were taken in captivity. There was a 605, a 597, a 586. Which deportation we count, we're not sure. And, of course, the decree was issued in 538. Now, these specific passages in Jeremiah are Jeremiah 25, 11 and 12, Jeremiah 29:10, and Jeremiah 50, 18 and 19 refer to the 70 years of captivity. Okay? Notice it says, the Spirit of the Lord... the Lord stirred up the spirit of Cyrus, the king of Persia. But this is the very same thing in chapter 5. It says God stirred up the exiles to go home. This is one of those very common phrases in a theology that God is in control of all of history, not just Israel. All men, all nations are under his control. So he sent a proclamation throughout all his kingdom and also put it in writing. The word for writing here is the technical term for written posters. Now, there's been some debate about the Hebrew decree found here in chapter 1 and the Aramaic decree in chapter 6. And there is a vast difference, although great similarity on major points. It seems that possibly the Hebrew was written for the proclamation among the Jews, and the Aramaic of chapter 6 was written for the temple archives, administrative archives. I'm not sure that's true, but maybe one was verbal and one was written. We're just not certain. It is amazing. This is documents from the Old Testament times that we have found Cyrus Cylinder. And I want to read you a little bit of what Cyrus says about why he let all these peoples go. He didn't let just the Jews go home and give them money to rebuild their temple. He let everybody. Let me read just a bit from it. To the cities of Asher and Susa, Agad, the cities of Zamban, Mitru, Dur, as far as the region of the land of Gudim, the holy cities beyond the Tigris, whose sanctuaries had been in ruins over a long period, the gods whose abode is in the midst of them, I returned to their places and houses and housed them in lasting abodes. I gathered together all the inhabitants and restored to them their dwellings. The god of Sumers and Akkad, whom Nabonidus had in the anger of the Lord of the gods, brought into Babylon, I, at the bidding of Marduk, the great lord, made to dwell in peace in their habitations, delightful abodes. May all the gods whom I have placed in their sanctuaries address a daily prayer in my favor to Baal and Nabu, that my days may be long, and they may say to Marduk, my lord, may Cyrus the king, who reveres thee, and Cambyses his son, on and on. Well, you see that he is not a Yahwehist, though he's going to have some names here of God. But he is a polytheist, and he wanted to return all these peoples and built them the temples of their native deities and said, look, y'all pray for me. So he's really covering all the bases, if you please. Now, this is what it says in verse 2. And thus says Cyrus, king of Persia, the Lord, the God of heaven. Now, he is going to use Jewish theology and phraseology in this edict. Now, obviously, he cooperated with the different racial groups in the name of their God and the appropriate way to say things. I'm not saying that Jews wrote this, but I'm saying they probably consulted Jews before it was written. Now, this idea about the Lord, the God of heaven, isn't it ironical? The whole phrase is the Lord of heaven and earth. Isn't it funny that this little group of Jews going back to a destroyed temple is claiming that their God is the God of all the earth? That's exactly what they believe, too, that monotheism is in place. Now, when it says the Lord God, by the way, Joseph, in his Antiquities of the Jews, chapter 11, verse 1, says the Jews showed Cyrus Isaiah 44:28 that mentions his name. Now, when I just read to you how superstitious he was and wanted all the gods' favor, it's obvious that the Jews were trying to show him that he was in the prophecy, and Cyrus certainly was excited about that. Has given me all the nations of the earth. Now, he attributes this to Marduk, but here he says to Yahweh. And he has appointed me to build a house in Jerusalem, which is in Judah. All right? By the way, the word Lord here in verse 2 is the word Yahweh, Y-H-W-H, from the Hebrew verb to be, Exodus 3:14, the covenant name for the God of Israel. Vulgate and the Septuagint add this, who is in Jerusalem. And I think that's probably true, because I think Cyrus still had the ideal of regional gods. I don't think Cyrus' theology was monotheism. It's obvious he was a polytheist and thought these gods were regional or lesser gods to Marduk. Okay? Now, verse 4. And every survivor. Now, some have said this refers to the exiles, the exiled who are returning home, which now become the remnant spoken of in Isaiah 10, 20 and following. And some think it refers to the Jews who were not exiled. Okay? Every survivor, at whatever place he may live, Jews that remained or the Jews in exile, both of the northern kingdoms and the southern kingdoms, let the men of that place support him with silver and gold and goods and cattle, together with a freewill offering for the house of the Lord, which is in Jerusalem. So here there's going to be support now from the temple treasury. They're going to give him the vessels of Yahweh's house that were found in the temples of Marduk and Nebo and Babylon. They're going to support the rebuilding of the temple, but they also want these Jews to give money to those who will return. So it's royal treasury and free will offerings is how they're going to do this. Then the heads of the fathers of the households of Judah. This would be the tribal leaders known as the elders, okay? Particularly Judah and Benjamin. And the priests and the Levites arose, even everyone whose spirit the Lord had stirred up. There God stirred up Cyrus, and God stirred up some of these 42,000 Jews to return home and rebuild the house of the Lord, which is in Jerusalem. And all those about him encouraged them with articles of silver and gold, with goods and cattle, with valuables, aside from all that was given as a freewill offering. Also King Cyrus brought out the articles of the house of the Lord. These articles were the vessels. Now, some were bronze, some were gold, some were silver. But they're the vessels like censers and fire pans and goblets and all the temple things that were used in the feast days. This refers to them. Now, you see these things in Jeremiah 52, 17 through 19, 2 Chronicles 36, 10, 2 Kings 24, 13, and Daniel 5, 2 through 4. And you compare Daniel 5, 2 through 4 with 2 Kings 24, 13, there seems to be a contradiction because it says in Kings that they were all cut up. But Daniel says that Belshazzar sent for some of the vessels to drink out of, so they couldn't have been all cut up. He probably cut up the larger pieces of gold, but kept the smaller things intact, and that seems to fit both. Now, which Nebuchadnezzar, and this is Nebuchadnezzar II, had carried away from Jerusalem and put in the house of his gods. That'd be Marduk and Nebo. And, of course, this whole thing is recorded in the books of Daniel, chapters 1 through 6. And Cyrus, the king of Persia, had brought them out by the hand of Mithridat. Now, Mithridat is a Persian, it's a Babylonian name, but it deals with one of the gods of the ancient Near East, Mithra, which is the disk of the sun. And apparently this person was a Babylonian or Persian who worshipped the sun. And he was a treasurer in Babylon, okay? Now, the next man, and he counted them out to Sheshbazzar. Now, he's called a prince of Judah, but that doesn't mean he's of the royal line. It simply means that he was a ruler of Judah. Now, some think that he is Zerubbabel's uncle from 1 Chronicles 3:18. That's Albright, primarily, and many have followed that because it solves the problem. And the major problem here, what is the relationship between Sheshbazzar and Zerubbabel? Now, both of them have Babylonian names. This Sheshbazzar comes from the Babylonian sun god, Shemesh. And Zerubbabel means origins in Babylon or born in Babel, something like that. Now, then in chapter 2, verse 1, it's going to say, chapter 2, verse 2, they went back under Zerubbabel. And yet it seems this Sheshbazzar is the governor first. Now, here's the theory. Some say that this was his uncle, and he died, and Zerubbabel took his place. Some say Zerubbabel and Sheshbazzar are the same name, same man with two different names. I really think they're two different men, chronologically speaking. And we've got several returns here. We've got an initial return under Sheshbazzar, a later return under Zerubbabel, another return under Ezra, and another return under Nehemiah. And there's several waves of these returns, I think. Now, notice it says in verse 9, and this was their number. And it's going to list several things here, gold and silver, dishes and all that. Notice the latter part of verse 9, it says 29 duplicates. Well, the Hebrew here is very uncertain. King James has the word knives. The Septuagint has the word changes, meaning priestly garments. And some think it means the word censer. Now, we just don't know what these words mean. They seem to be a list from the archives of Babylon. And that's why the names are hard for these Jewish people. By the way, when you look at verse 11 and the total numbers given, it's far greater than what's listed here. Now, there is a terrible number problem in these post-exilic books. Many people think the reason that 2 Ezra does not fit Nehemiah 7 is because of number problems with the copyist. And the numbers were so hard and so difficult, and they're so different that I think that really is probably what we have here. Now, in chapter 2 is a long, detailed list of people that return. Now, I think there's two reasons for that. Number one, they wanted to show that they were the theological remnant of the people of Israel. They were the fulfillment of prophecy. They were the same Israel. And second, the land inheritance was based on family. So there's several lists through here now. Notice it says, and these are the people of the province who came up out of captivity. Then notice it says, return to Jerusalem and Judah, each to his own city. Jerusalem was resettled and some of the cities right around it. Okay, the province of Judah was not very big in this time, okay? Now, the number of the men, the sons of Israel. Now, this is exactly duplicated. Well, I say exactly. It's supposed to be exactly duplicated in Nehemiah 7 with some great number problems. All right? In verses 3 through 20, we have those who can prove their descent by a genealogy record. In verses 20 through 35 is those who are trying to prove their descendants by the location that they were settled in, apparently in Babylon. And then in verses 59 and 60 are those who can't prove it, and they cannot act as priests. Now, there are several groups through here. The first group of men is mentioned here in verses down 3 through, let's see, 35. And then in 36, we have the rest of the chapter, we have several groups of temple servants. We have the priest in 36, the Levites, but who were not priests, in 40, the temple singers in 41, the temple doorkeepers in 42, the temple servants, those who served the Levites, in 43 and following, and a special group of slaves in 55 through 58. And so it's a long list of those who returned. Now, the priest here. In 1 Chronicles 24, 7 through 19, we know that David put 24 different divisions of priests, family groupings, to minister in certain times in the temple. From the list here, only four of those groups return, and only three of those are mentioned in 2 Chronicles 24. The other is of a different priestly line going back to Aaron that will be included finally. Okay? Now, I will see chapter 10, verses 18 through 22, where they're mentioned again. Let's see. The Levites now... Every priest was a Levite, but not all Levites were priests. Some of them did menial service, and there's quite a few of them that returned, okay? Notice the singers, they're Asaph. Now, there were three groups of singers in David's day, Asaph, Hanan, and Jeduthun. Well, the other two, Hanan and Jeduthun, never returned. Why? We don't know. Now, the sons of the gatekeepers are mentioned here, and you might see 1 Chronicles 25, 1 through 26, 19, where these special groups are mentioned. Then we have the temple servants, and they're called the Nithinim, which means those that are given. And they seem to be foreigners by their names. David had a lot of people in his foreigners in his army, we learn, from 2 Samuel 15, 18 through 22. And there were some foreign servants in the temple, maybe people who were captured and made slaves in the sense of serving the temple. We know that's true of the Gibeonites in Joshua 9:27. We learn from Ezekiel 44, 6 through 31, that he was against these uncircumcised people in the temple, and he seems to be referring to this group. Now, in verse 55, it says the sons of Solomon's servant. Apparently, Solomon added some to David's servants, and that's the list here. We don't know for certain. In verse 55, the term Heshophereth, and in verse 57, that long name, compound name, are both feminine, which seem to imply guilds or types of people instead of family names. Now, notice in verse 63, we have the word governor again. Now, Zerubbabel is called governor by a different name in Haggai 1:1 and in Ezra 5:14. But here, apparently refers to Sheshbazzar, and their relationship has really caused a lot of tension, so I'm just not sure. Notice that it says, apparently it's the man who made the decision about these ones who couldn't prove their genealogy, and they wouldn't let them eat the most holy things, which means the part of the sacrifice that the priest ate, because the rest was offered on the altar, and they ate this most holy thing. Well, those who couldn't prove their lineage could not be priests. Now, the Urim and the Thummim is mentioned. They're mentioned in Exodus 28:30, Numbers 27:21. They're kind of like holy dice. They told the will of God. The high priest used them, kept them in his ephod. But here, they're either lost, or they have to wait till the priests are installed before they're usable. We have no record of them being used after, I think, the time of David and Solomon. Now, notice the whole assembly is numbered in verse 64, 42,360. Now, this number is the same both in Ezra and in Nehemiah and in the apocryphal book of 1 Esdras. But when you add up the individuals in these three books, you get three different totals. When you add up the list of Ezra, you only get 29,818. When you add up the list of Nehemiah 7, you get 31,089. When you add up the apocryphal book of 1 Esdras, you get 33,950. But the total is the same in all of them. That tells me we've got a real number problem here, and I don't think we can solve it. Now, notice where it mentions these 200 singers in verse 65. Those are secular singers, not temple singers. And notice the horses and all. Now, the money down in verse 69 seems to be from Darius the First. He's the first one to coin money. He apparently got it from Lydia in Asia Minor. It was picked up by the Greeks, but this seems to be a D-A-R-I-C-S, which is Persian, and it 50 of them to a shekel. And that seems to be what's here. The equivalents differ again in Nehemiah 7. Let me go on to chapter 3 then, which begins the setting up of the foundations of the temple. And this seems to be under Zerubbabel. Now, it says that Sheshbazzar set the foundations in chapter 5. Now, apparently, Sheshbazzar maybe cleared off the area and found the ancient foundation stones, but something happened to him. He died or whatever. And later, Zerubbabel came in the year in Darius the first reign. This is Cyrus's where Sheshbazzar comes. But it seems to be in Darius the first when Zerubbabel comes, and he is said to lay the foundation. But the Hebrew word has a very wide range of meaning. And so I think it was started by Sheshbazzar. It was continued by Zerubbabel under the influence and encouragement of Haggai and Zechariah. Okay? Now, the walls of the city will not be built until Nehemiah, down the time of Malachi. All right? Now, when the seventh month came, the seventh month is Tishri, the October, September. This is one of the major feast days of the Jewish calendar. The first month, the third month, and the seventh month were the major cultic months. In the seventh month, we had the Feast of Trumpets, Leviticus 23:24. On the tenth day, we had the Day of Atonement, Leviticus 16. And on the 15th through 22nd, we had the Feast of Booths, which they're going to do as soon as they return. Now, they all gathered from the surrounding region as one man. Women and children came together. And notice it mentions Joshua or Jesus. This guy's the same name. He's not called the high priest here, but he is in Zechariah and Haggai. And he's the son, and he is really the grandson of the high priest when the temple fell under Zedekiah. Okay? Notice the God of Israel, which is the covenant title. Verse 3, so they set up the altar on its foundations, for they were terrified because of the people of the land. Now, this is either because of the people we learn in chapter 4, which would be Sanballat of Samaria and Tobiah of Ammon, who tried to stop the rebuilding, or it was the Jews who were not exiled who got mad because they tore the old altar down and built a new one. Now, one of those two is right, and which one I can't be sure. It mentions the morning and evening sacrifice, see Exodus 28:42 and Numbers 28:3-6. This would be 9 a.m. in the morning, 3 p.m. in the afternoon. And they celebrated the Feast of Booths. Now, there's several things here. The sacrifices are found in Numbers 19:12-38, and in itself is found in Exodus 23:16 and 34:22. Okay? It mentions new moons and festival days. These are set times of sacrifice in the Jewish calendar. In verse 6, we have this term, but the foundations of the temple of the Lord had not been laid. Now, it says in chapter 5 that Sheshbazzar did that. And it seems to be a contradiction until you realize the wide usage of this term. Matter of fact, in 2 Chronicles 24:12 and following, it's used for the remodeling of Josiah's temple. While in Haggai 2:18, it means a finishing of the foundations. And that Haggai passage seems to be correct. Haggai 2:18. In verse 7, they're going to pay for the material from Lebanon with food and grain. This is exactly what Solomon did. There seems to be a real play on trying the same timing, the same materials, the same format of Solomon's temple. You might want to see 2 Chronicles chapter 2, verse 9, where Solomon also paid for these cedars of Lebanon with oil. Notice in verse 8 it says, in the second month, this is exactly when Solomon's temple was started construction. We find that from 1 Kings 6:1 and 2 Chronicles 3:2. So there's a real patterning after Solomon's temple here. Now in verse 10 it mentions that they blew the trumpets and clashed the cymbals. Now the blowing of trumpets was a very important thing. Numbers 10:8, Numbers 31:6, Joshua 6:4. 1 Chronicles 15:24, 16:6, 2 Chronicles 5:12. They have religious significance, military significance, and this cultic significance. Now the cymbals are also crashed a lot by the singers of Asaph, 1 Chronicles 15:16, 19, 16:3, 25:6, and 2 Chronicles 7:6. So a lot of music was involved and singing in preparation for setting up the temple. In verse 11, we have the two covenant names for God, the word the Lord, Yahweh, and the word Hesed, the verb, his loving kindness, which is God's no strings attached covenant loyalty. So here are the two unique verbs used for the God of Israel, which encouraged them that the covenant was back in play, Yahweh and Hesed. Now the climax comes in verse 11 where they just shout and sing and praise God. The temple's restored. They're back in the land. God has kept his promises. But look at verse 12 and 13. The ones who saw Solomon's temple, when they finally saw this rebuilt temple, they wept and wailed because it was so little. We see an allusion to that in Haggai chapter 2, verse 3 and following, and Zechariah 4:10. And those prophets preached to that. Don't despise it because it's small. Get back, get that temple finished, it was their cry. And so it says, though, those who were shouting were louder than those who were weeping, and other people couldn't tell the difference. So it seems to be a funny ending to this, such a great time of the rebuilding of the temple. This section of Ezra seems very detailed. This is not the great theology of Romans chapter 8. But it's important for us to understand the theological motives behind God fulfilling His promises to bring them back to the land, to reinstitute the cultus, and to fulfill His prophecies both through Isaiah and Jeremiah and Ezekiel. And this is the beginning of that. It's very detailed because the men involved are using, apparently, Persian documents. And they're being very historical. So it's not the most exciting passage of Scripture I ever dealt with, but it is going to help us understand the New Testament. I've enjoyed being with you, and I'll see you again, same time, same place, next week.